with his hands outlining an imaginary pile of money. Very big pile, looks very nice. If I asked him the question he wanted me to ask, how was it that you were able to see $1 million in cash, Tommy? I knew he was going to back off, get defensive, or make a joke. So I didn't say anything. I just sat there in the car with Tommy and his imaginary pile of money. Last night I had vision. I think we need to do Chris Arsene again, but on roof. It would be spectacular. He's such good character, like Al Capone. My idea is that when we fight him, the gun would fall off the roof, like in gangster movie. As the room's line producer, I felt obliged to ask, you want to shoot the Chris Arsene again? I don't like the dailies. They just don't cut it. We need something bigger, more spectacular. For Tommy, bigger and more spectacular meant green screen. The green screen was like a portal into Tommy's imagination, and having it as an option gave him a scarily limitless range of possibilities. A few days before, Tommy had pulled Raphael aside and told him his latest big idea. I want my car, Tommy began, to fly off the roof and into the sky. By now, Raphael was prepared for literally anything when Tommy discussed his ideas. Even so, I could tell this particular vision had really deeply stunned him. Why, Raphael said, do you want to do this exactly? It's just possible side plot, maybe Johnny is vampire. Raphael stood there looking up at the sky. He began to nod. The next time I saw Raphael, he was laughing uncontrollably while he relayed Tommy's flying Mercedes-Benz vampire vision to one of the cameramen. Now, in the car on the way to the set, Tommy said, you see how creative I am? Somebody's good director. I said nothing. I couldn't get over how much effort reshooting the Chris R scene on the rooftop set would entail. You see, Tommy said, you never give me credit. No one ever give me credit. Well, I give myself credit. The biggest problem with reshooting the Chris R scene was that Tommy no longer had half the characters the scene called for. Dan Janjigian was long gone. Brianna, who was included in the version of the scene shot in the alley, had been fired. Tommy gathered Philip, Carolyn Minot, and Juliet, all of whom would figure prominently in the scene's new rooftop version, to explain why it was being reshot. He described how much more dramatic it would be. He described the gun falling off the side of the roof. He mentioned Al Capone. He also added an additional and pretty significant detail, which was that Chris R would actually be firing his gun in the air during the scene. But before Tommy could start reshooting, we still needed to confirm Chris R's involvement. Neither I nor anyone on set could imagine that Dan would be willing to come back and reprise his role, given the general wackiness of his experience with Tommy. I told Tommy as much, but he didn't see a problem. Get this guy here now! No excuses! I explained that Dan probably couldn't report for acting duty today, or ever, and that it was ridiculous to expect anyone to come in with only a few hours' notice. Well, Tommy said huffily, then I guess he's not a professional actor. So I called Dan. He didn't answer. Call him again now, Tommy said. A few minutes later, I found a quiet spot on the set and called again. This time, Dan picked up right away. Tommy hasn't blown up Burns and Sawyer yet? He asked. No, I said, but he's working on it. What are you up to? With my girlfriend. Doing a little shopping at Ralph's. Tommy, standing at the other side of the lot, saw me talking on the phone and started yelling. Greg, tell him we need him here now! We don't have time for BSing! I covered the receiver to shield Dan from hearing Tommy and went for a little walk around the block. "Yeah," I said. "So get this. You ready?" Uh-oh. "Tommy wants to reshoot the drug deal thing you were in. He wants to do it on the rooftop set. Also, he wants to do it now." Silence. As in right now. Immediately. "Good one," Dan said, but he knew I wasn't kidding. "Yeah, so you ready to become Chris R again?" "Why on the rooftop?" Dan asked. "I don't know. He said something about it being more dramatic. He wants you back on set ASAP. That's pretty much all he said." Dan was quiet. Later, he told me that he thought about how relieved he'd been when his room gig ended, but then, weirdly, how much he'd kind of enjoyed being an actor. Maybe doing it again would be fun. He also wondered if there might be more scenes in the movie for him if he really managed to wow Tommy. Like everyone else in the cast, Dan had no idea what the script was about. All he'd been given was his scene. For all he knew, the whole film was crawling with charismatic drug dealers. "I can't believe I'm saying this," Dan said, "but all right, I'll come by tomorrow around 1. Actually, wait, how about you let me know when you're headed over? I know Tommy, no matter what time we settle on, he'll be 4 hours late." "Good call," I said. "You're a wise man." Dan laughed. "Am I?" I passed the good news on to Tommy. His response, "He should come now. Tommy, he's grocery shopping with his girlfriend." Tommy shook his head sadly. "Not everybody has dedication. We prepare now, anyway. First, we do test of me running onto roof. Then we prepare with gun, etc., etc. When gun falls off roof, I want big struggle. We may do crazy stuff, so be prepared. Then I review footage." We obviously weren't shooting anything today. The actor most central to the scene Tommy wanted to shoot wasn't even present. Even so, he decreed that no crew or cast member could leave the set. He wanted a full day's worth of rehearsal for a scene we'd already rehearsed and shot. This was, at best, an extravagant use of everyone's time. When the complaints started coming in, Tommy had this to say. "Rehearsal is very important. You need preparation. You can't just do scene in 5 minutes. The next day, Dan emerged from wardrobe already in character. If anything, he had taken his Chris R game up a notch. Even though we'd moved out of the alley set, Tommy still wanted Denny to open the scene dribbling his basketball. The rooftop, I probably don't need to point out, had no basketball hoop. Sandy tried to talk Tommy out of this, but Tommy saw no logical issue with Denny practicing his dribbling on a condo rooftop. "He plays basketball," Tommy said. "Let Denny do what he wants. You can play basketball without hoop. I do it all the time. It's fun." Philip and Dan now joined Tommy on the rooftop set. His initial direction was impressively without substance.
"Okay, we begin with the Chris R talking to Danny. Danny tried to trick him a little bit. Chris R, your voice go up. Danny, you get scared."
Between rehearsals, Dan again began stalking around the rooftop's pavement edge, swearing to stay angry and in character. Philip watched him, looking more and more worried, having already been mauled once by Dan. "I think you're in for a good time," I said to him. "Yeah," Philip said. "A blast." Sandy and Tommy stood by one of the monitors. Tommy was wearing big gray headphones with pastry-sized ear cushions, his long black hair spilling over his shoulders. After the 8th or 9th time through the scene, Dan turned to Tommy and said, "Why do I keep saying the same line over and over again? Where's my fucking money? Can't I mix it up or something? Vary it a little?"
"We will not change lines," Tommy said, his eyes not leaving his monitor.
You want to be actor? Act like one. Tommy's response only made Dan angrier, and for the next couple of run-throughs, it looked as though Philip were about to melt in terror as Dan pressed him for his fucking money. Although the effect Tommy's response had on Dan was unintended, the moment nonetheless stands as one of the only successful things I ever saw Tommy do as a director. So yes, as unlikely as it may sound, the scene between Chris R. and Denny actually did get better on the rooftop, no thanks to Tommy's wizardly direction. He kept telling Dan to imitate Denny during the confrontation scene. It took everyone a while to realize that Tommy wanted Dan to intimidate Denny. Tommy hit his first real snag when it came to the moment he cherished most, Chris R. firing a warning shot in the air to frighten Denny. Tommy seemed to believe that if he wanted the gun to fire, it should. But prop guns need blanks. Tommy began to talk about sending the art department out for blanks immediately, but Sandy wasn't comfortable with this. Tommy, he said, the last thing we need right now is... I stopped you right there, Tommy said, stopping him right there. This is Hollywood. Everything is possible. If Hitchcock hear you talk like this, he would fire you on the spot. You, Sandy said, laughing, are not Hitchcock, my friend. That is your business, Tommy said. I am not Hitchcock. I'm myself. What? Sandy said, confounded. The debate ended when Bill Muir got word of what Tommy wanted to do. Through Peter Anway, we learned that Mr. Muir would not tolerate a gun going off on the premises of his retail business. Tommy was disappointed but said nothing. Hearing from Muir was, in Tommy's mind, like hearing from God. Besides, his other beloved idea for the scene, the gun somehow flying off the roof when Mark and Johnny disarmed Chris R., was still in play. Until it wasn't. Sandy pointed out that there was no good way to dramatize the gun flying off the roof without a lot of extra camera and blocking work. Raphael's resistance was more boldly stated. If you knock the gun out of that guy's hand, he said, pointing at Dan, he would tear both of you to pieces. That's true, Dan said, I would. And if you don't believe it, let's try rehearsing it your way, Tommy. We came to the moment in which Johnny and Mark launched themselves out of the tin-roofed outhouse to disarm Chris R. and rescue Denny. Due to the outhouse's solitary confinement dimensions, Tommy and I had to run out of it separately. Tommy was adamant that we both have intense expressions on our faces when we emerged. This was, for Tommy, a pure action hero moment. As soon as we finished shooting our first run-through of the scene, Tommy wanted to watch the results on playback. He was terribly impressed with his intensity and deeply disappointed in mine. Tommy emerged from the outhouse looking like he just discovered Chris R. eating Denny's intestines. I looked like I'd discovered two strangers playing jacks. I couldn't take it seriously. I finally did my best approximation of Tommy's wide-eyed, oh-mouth expression and burst into laughter the second Sandy called cut. It was good enough for Tommy. We moved on. Now all we had to do was film our attempt to disarm Chris R., which had turned out so badly the first time through on the alley set. Our runs on the rooftop, sadly, were just as pathetic. Dan actually stopped in the middle of one take and wheeled around on Tommy and said, "If you're going to grab my arm, really fucking grab it. You're jumping on me like a pussy." With that, he headed off to shout some more expletives. "My God," Tommy said, watching Dan go. "He's like monster." As hard as it may be to believe, it took us 2 weeks to film this whole sequence, including the part of the scene that involved Carolyn and Juliet. This is about the same amount of time it took Steven Spielberg to shoot the D-Day landing sequence in Saving Private Ryan. But even though Dan's scenes were finished in a few days, Tommy forbade him to ever leave the set. "Tommy," Dan said, "if I'm not doing any more filming, there's no reason for me to be here." But we may need you, Tommy said. There's still more scenes in the script for your character. Maybe we use them, maybe not. Really? Dan said, warily. Chris R is big character, Tommy said. Can I see the script then? That would be helpful for me.
I'm sorry, but you cannot. It's confidential at this time.
When Dan asked me if it was true that Chris R had more scenes in the film, I was straight with him. There weren't any in the script I'd seen, but then again, Tommy had recently been planning for a subplot involving Johnny's flying vampire car. If Dan stuck around, it was entirely possible that the film could turn into The Room, the story of Chris R's gun. When Dan realized that Tommy had no plans to use him again, and that his time was being wasted, he presented Tommy with an $80 receipt for a new pair of Skechers boots he'd purchased.
What is this? Tommy asked.
You stepped on my boots so many times during our scene, they got all scuffed. I had to replace them. I'd like to be reimbursed.
I am not the Santa Claus, Tommy said, turning away.
Dan grabbed Tommy by the arm and kept him there. He reminded Tommy that he'd been promised a full wardrobe during filming, but no one had given him boots. He'd thus worn his own, which were damaged. Replacing them was Tommy's responsibility. Dan explained all this to Tommy calmly, but there was an unbreakable steel rod in his voice. Tommy, I think, gulped before saying that he'd have to ask his producers for permission. Tommy, Dan said, not letting go of his arm, I do speeches for $5,000 a day. I run a business, a professional one. If you're really an honest businessman, as you claim to be, and you're really true to your word, as you claim to be, you wouldn't be fighting me on this. Right now, you're being unprofessional.
We are very professional, Tommy said quietly.
Dan let Tommy go.
Good.
Then be a man and pay for my boots. Tommy ran his hand through his hair and looked around.
I need check.
Tommy balked at replacing Dan's $80 Skechers. I later learned that Tommy's decision to reshoot the Chris R scene, a scene, I should note, that had no impact on the film's plot, cost the production over $80,000. That is how it went every day. Tommy behaving like a gregarious spender one moment and a brutal miser the next. It wasn't new behavior. He'd been like this since I'd known him. Once, back in San Francisco, I was in a Big Five store with Tommy. He was shopping for workout gloves. A pair of rollerblades caught his eye, though, and after trying them on, he spent an hour rollerblading around the store saying, "So beautiful, I love it." He ended up grabbing four pairs of rollerblades to take home with him. When he went to pay, Tommy asked the cashier what kind of discount he could get. The cashier said it was a set price store.
"Oh, come on, be good sport," Tommy said. "Give me discount. How about $5 discount? Student ID or something?"
The cashier laughed.
"My God," Tommy said, "she's so difficult. Somebody doesn't understand American way."
He pulled this stuff constantly, even in restaurants.
"How about we pay for one drink and you give us two? Come on, be good salesman."
Tommy, I guess, utterly rejected the idea that the entire point of Western civilization is not having to haggle like a peasant every time money changes hands. Strangely, though, Tommy never haggled at Burns and Sawyer, maybe because he desperately wanted to be accepted as their golden boy. Whenever Peter Anway suggested that Tommy needed to buy something, Tommy usually did.
"We are first-class production," he'd say,
right before slapping a Wizzo film sticker on his new purchase. For the record, I don't fault Bill Muir and Peter Anway for taking Tommy's money. They were running a business, and when someone turns up on your showroom floor determined to spend, the businessman's duty is to accommodate him. Still, I imagine it came as something of a shock to Anway when he found himself listed in the room's credits as one of Tommy's five assistants. Three executive producers were listed in the room's credits. One, Chloe Litsky, whose nighttime conversation with Tommy I'd overheard during our James Dean road trip, was a much older woman who lived in Oakland, was confined to a wheelchair, and had never been involved in film production before, during, or after The Room. Another, Drew Caffrey, with whom Tommy became close soon after moving to San Francisco, had been deceased for years at the time of the film's production. Along with being the executive producer, Caffrey was credited as another one of Tommy's assistants and the San Francisco casting director, making him the busiest dead person since Tupac Shakur. The only real executive producer was, of course, Tommy Wiseau himself. In other words, The Room had no producers, which Tommy knew that I knew. That didn't stop him from lying about it to me. Whenever any issue came up that Tommy wanted to deflect, he attributed his needs to what the producers wanted. This was also a way of creating the illusion that Tommy had confidently navigated Hollywood's upper echelons. And it worked. Initially, at least, no one involved in the production doubted the existence of these producers. Considering how much money Tommy was throwing around, how could they have? But eventually, members of the cast and crew began asking, "What the hell is this really all about? Where is Tommy from? Where is he getting all this money?" I told them I didn't know. After knowing Tommy for 15 years, I still don't know how he originally acquired his money. What I do know is this. Whenever Raphael or Sandy discussed with Tommy ways to be more cost-efficient, Tommy responded, "We don't worry about money. We worry about movie." Anyone with that attitude is not operating out of a normal economic framework. The question then becomes, what types of businesses are capable of generating a cash flow that allows one to spend $500,000 on a never-screened HD film? Tommy poured money into promoting the ultimate flop, despite making no profit for years. He spent tens of thousands of dollars on merchandise. He spent $5,000 per month for 5 years, keeping up a Highland Avenue billboard advertising the film. He spent thousands of dollars a month paying one theater in Los Angeles to screen The Room, earning a return on his investment somewhere between $100 and $200 per month, if that. If you want to make large amounts of money disappear, this is certainly one way to do it. But at a certain point, don't even money laundering schemes diversify? So it didn't surprise me when I heard whispers on the set about the source of Tommy's money. But here's the thing. The last person I would ever entrust to oversee any part of any criminal enterprise would be Tommy Wiseau. In fact, were I involved in illegal activity, I would think twice before launching a criminal enterprise in a country where Tommy Wiseau was even a resident. And after all, if you were the legal face of a presumably international money laundering scheme, what on earth would impel you to try to get the world's attention by becoming a movie star? And why would your less public colleagues allow you to do so? When I told friends about Tommy early on, his secrecy, his wealth, his cheapness, and his frivolousness, they always warned me to be careful. I recall one friend saying, "Just wait, one of these days there'll be a knock at your door and it'll be an FBI agent." But after knowing Tommy for a decade and a half, I've never gotten a call or a knock. There were never any suspicious, or really any, people around him. Money is what allowed Tommy to not only produce and release The Room, but also to extensively advertise it and keep it alive in the dark time between its disastrous initial release and eventual cult success. The origins of all this money are still unknown. Money, you could say, is the elephant in the room. 8. May all your dreams come true. The funny thing is, I'm not pretending to be someone else, and you are. Tom Ripley, the talented Mr. Ripley. I was driving through Central California with the windows of my Lumina open to the rural, manure-laden air. It had been 18 days since I'd first seen Tommy's apartment. Earlier that Thursday afternoon, on a whim, I decided to move to LA. What was I waiting for? I dreamed of this moment since I was 12. Now I was actually doing it. Before leaving Tommy's apartment, a little over 2 weeks before, I'd grabbed a stack of his ancient Hollywood reporters and brought them with me to San Francisco. Back home in my bedroom, I paged through them one by one, figuring out which agencies I wanted to approach. In one of the more recent issues, I read an interview with a famous young actor represented by the Iris Burton Agency. I did a little research and learned Iris had started out with a small boutique agency that had since become the stuff of legend in the business. According to that legend, Iris became the first, and I'm guessing remains the only, agent able to secure a contract for a fetus. Iris had a particular gift for representing young actors who succeeded in bucking the typical young actor trend of being washed up at 20. River Phoenix, Drew Barrymore, Jerry O'Connell, the Olsen twins, Hilary Duff, Joaquin Phoenix, Kirsten Dunst, Josh Hartnett, these were just some of Iris's clients. A casting director in San Francisco told me that Iris was someone who could get Steven Spielberg on the phone. I sent Iris, along with a bunch of other agents, my headshot and resume. For my contact info, I used my new apartment's phone number, which didn't yet have a phone hooked up, though I plan to rectify that immediately. That phone number is still working, incidentally. It now serves as the room hotline. Feel free to call it if you'd like to hear Tommy personally invite you to a screening. 323-654-6192. After 7 hours, I made it to Sunset Boulevard, feeling a bit automotively emasculated among a sudden blitz of Porsches and Ferraris. I didn't care. I was damn proud of my Lumina, which hadn't broken down once on this drive. I came to Los Angeles to do a big movie, something with a huge impact, like Interview with the Terminator. I was here now, and I could make it happen. And it was all thanks to Tommy, wasn't it? I wonder what he was doing up in San Francisco. Probably vamping out in his lair, getting ready to sell some pirated Levi's, and good for him. I had nothing but appreciation for the man at this moment. Around 2 a.m., I parked at Tommy's complex and hauled my luggage, a duffel bag filled mostly with socks, up to the third floor. There was the door, my home. I was at the end of my first night in Los Angeles and about to crash in my new apartment. I got to the door, pulled out the key, stuck it in. It wouldn't open. I tried again. I tried for 10 minutes. Nothing budged. This was, quite obviously, the wrong key. Tommy gave me the wrong fucking key. The apartment manager's office was, of course, closed. I didn't have a cell, so my first order of business was to get to a payphone. I found a Chevron gas station on Sunset and called Tommy Collect. He didn't answer, so I waited in the gas station for a few minutes and fulminated. In the short time I had known Tommy, I had learned this much. He had established an entirely new category of personal disorganization. You know better, I thought. You should have gotten the key from him when you first saw the apartment, you idiot. I called Tommy again, very much hoping that my first night in Los Angeles would not be spent in my Lumina. This time, he answered. After accepting the charges, he said, "I'm listening." "Tommy?" "Oh, hey, how is Babyface?" "The keys don't work. The manager's office is closed. Do you have a spare somewhere?" "What?" "The keys don't work," I don't know what I'm going to do.
Oh, come on, try again, it works.
He sounded jovial, playful even. Why did I bother calling him? Even if Tommy's organizational skills weren't so hopeless, what could he do from San Francisco at this hour? Teleport? I didn't want to get mad at Tommy, because he'd been so cool and supportive. But the only way to keep from getting mad at him was to end our conversation immediately. It's late, I said. Don't worry, I'll figure something out. Maybe a hotel.
No, no, he said. Don't stay in hotel. You have your own place now.
Thanks, Tommy. I still can't get the door open.
I'm here if you need anything.
What I needed was for the key to work. My next move was to drive east down Sunset Boulevard, looking for a side street to pull over and go to sleep. Sunset Boulevard at 3 a.m. is not the most welcoming place, and I soon realized I was liable to be robbed, or worse, if I slept in my car. And the farther east down Sunset I went, the rougher, darker, and stabbier it got. Out of this unpleasant darkness, the blinky lights of the Saharan Motel emerged. The place had an Egyptian theme. More interesting yet was the part of its sign that read $59.99 or hourly rates. I was a sheltered 20-year-old from Northern California, but even I knew from which segment of society the Saharan likely lured most of its customers. I pulled in, only to be greeted by a gentleman of Middle Eastern descent who ran out of his check-in hut screaming at the top of his lungs, "Turn your car! Move your fucking car!" The man yelled at me some more when I got out and walked over to him. "I need a room," I said. Happily, there was one vacancy left. After procuring my key from the still-screaming man, I walked to my room past several dead palm trees and an empty swimming pool. I could smell rotting Indian food, and yep, people were actually getting it on in the rooms. Not in a nice, loving way, either. As I was opening my door, a trash, middle-aged man with two wobbly-legged prostitutes young enough to be his daughters emerged from the room next to mine. "Hello," I said. They laughed the cruel laughter of the damned. My first night in Los Angeles, and I'm in a hooker motel. "Thank you, Tommy." I couldn't sleep. I reclined in all my clothes on top of the still-made bed, which smelled like the perspiration of hundreds, wondering what on earth I was going to do in the morning. Someone started knocking through the bars on my street-side window.
"Hey, man," a voice said. "Hey, do you have some beer? Can you help me out?"
His voice was creepy and desperate, and so close, it was as though he were standing at the foot of my bed. Eventually, I was able to close my eyes. I have lived in Los Angeles for more than a decade, and never seen it smoggier than the first morning I awoke as an official resident of the city. I drove through this wicked blue-gray haze back to Tommy's apartment building, the manager of which, Stacy, seemed resistant to the idea that I should be living there. Stacy was younger and kind of cute, with glasses that made her look like the secret identity Wonder Woman never had. I finally convinced Stacy to give me the key, though we wound up debating the correct pronunciation of Tommy's last name. Wiso, Weesaw. It was clear that she didn't believe Tommy and I were cousins. I didn't blame her. Nor did I want to contemplate what else she thought. I unpacked my socks, napped for a while, then went back to my car for my big-ticket move-in item, a colossal fax machine phone my father had lying around. It was about the size of a European economy car, but I found just the place for it. Beneath Tommy's crummy television were two small white Doric-style pillars. You can see these pillars and that television at several points in the room. So I decided to swap out Tommy's television with my fax machine. I stuck the phone cord into the jack and had begun to do something else when, out of nowhere, the phone rang. I hadn't recorded an outgoing message yet, So I waited for the allotted six rings to pass. Then a voice said, "I'm calling for Greg Sestero. I received your headshot and resume and would like to set up a meeting for next week." Given where I'd spent the previous night, this seemed like an unusually auspicious turn of events. 5 minutes later, another call. Same gist. "This message is for Greg Sestero. We're interested in meeting you regarding representation. Different agent." When, 10 minutes later, I got another call from another agent, I started to laugh with awe. Then I learned who exactly was calling. "Hey, Greg, this is Chris from the Iris Burton Agency. I got your package. I want to set up a meeting for next week." I probably replayed that message 20 times before I convinced myself it wasn't some sort of joke. Iris Burton's agency really had called me. This was my Harvard acceptance letter. I called everyone back and set up meetings. I scheduled the Iris Burton meeting for later in the week, which I hoped would allow me to gain some educational experience before I had to face her. My first meeting was in a bland corporate office on Melrose with a blandly friendly agent. Everything about it felt generic. "I'd love to see some of the stuff you've done," she said. I mentioned I'd studied with Gene Shelton. The woman had no idea who Gene Shelton was. Clearly trying to salvage our sad, forgettable meeting, she abruptly ended with, "Can you get your demo reel to me?" That was not going to happen. I had never even seen the episode of Nash Bridges that I was on, and I didn't have my Patch Adams footage either. Not that it would help, I was only a glorified extra. In the next meeting, I might have given the agent the impression that my role in Patch Adams and my relationship with the film's director, Tom Shadyac, were slightly more significant than they were. She then started telling me that she'd recently seen Shadyac and teased him about having all of these hit movies, Ace Ventura, The Nutty Professor, Liar Liar. He was on such a roll, she told him, that he should open his own movie studio. Ha ha, etc. She promised she'd mention me to Shadyac the next time she saw him. "Oh," I said lightly, "don't even mention it." What I meant was, damn it, please don't mention it. "We'd really like to see some of your work," she said as we parted. Once again, I left completely demoralized. It was becoming clear that I'd need tape before anyone would consider representing me. Next, I met with a younger male agent who was dressed like a mannequin. He didn't talk to me so much as lob insults disguised as professional concern. "You've got a lot of work to do, a lot of work ahead of you. You need tape, experience, and a new look. Get all of those things and we can talk." "Okay," I said, standing up. Then he said this, "I've got some meetings with friends tonight, but after, do you want to play tennis?" I knew a euphemism when I heard one. "Actually," I said, "I can't." He nodded, frowned, reached into his desk. "Let me give you my card." He looked at me as he handed it over. "If you ever want to play." Iris Burton was my final meeting. None of the fancy clothes I'd worn to previous meetings seemed to be working, so I put on my normal casual attire. A short sleeve button down and cargo shorts. For Iris Burton, I wanted to be as genuine as I knew how to be. And at this point in my life, that meant, God help me, wearing shorts. I was a little confused when I first approached Iris's address. It wasn't an office building, but a house in a Beverly Hills neighborhood, the exterior of which was dominated by rose gardens. In the driveway was a new black Mercedes, as well as a motorcycle. I was approaching the place warily when I saw Joaquin Phoenix coming out of the guest house. We walked down the long driveway toward each other. I tried to pretend it was no big deal running into him. "Hey," he said, quick and relaxed. "Hey," I said back, just as quickly, but manifestly less relaxed. Inside the guest house was Chris, the man who'd left a message on my phone, and who was Iris Burton's executive assistant. He wore a Caesar cut and expensive clothes, and stood a couple of inches taller than me, and I'm not short. I liked Chris instantly. There was no Hollywoodish vibe to him at all. He wasn't trying to intimidate, impress, belittle, or seduce me. I came in and he smiled, shook my hand, and told me to sit down. He talked, I listened. I talked, he listened. "We're always trying to find people who fit the agency," he said. I told him I'd come from San Francisco and related some of my close calls, or the calls I was discussing as though they'd been close, for instance, that I'd read for the Virgin Suicides. "Really?" he said. "What part?" "Because we have two clients on that, Kirsten and Josh." I was up for Tripfontaine. "Josh's role," he said. "I guess so," I said. "Yeah." Chris smiled. "Let's see those headshots of yours," he said mercifully. I had brought in all the contact sheets from my most recent headshot session, which we spread out on Chris's desk. "These are great, actually," he said, and started telling me about the kinds of calls he'd feel good sending me out on. I could tell this was different. I sensed he was thinking about what he could do for me. Then the dreaded question came. "Do you have some tape we can see?" I just stared. I felt defeated. I wanted to say, "Come on, Chris, after everything we've been through." Tape was like this roadblock that had no room around it. As I sat there attempting to come up with something exculpatory to say, Chris looked back at my contact sheets and said once again, mercifully, "How about we send you out and see what happens?" "Okay," I said. "Thank you," I thought. Just hearing that made me want to hug Chris, but I managed to contain myself. Such a simple gesture on his part, but it meant so much. Chris got on the phone with someone. He didn't dial. "Can you come check something out for a second?" Moments later, I heard the sound of high heels coming from deeper inside the house, and then Iris Burton herself was standing in the doorway. This was a woman who'd played a heathen dancer in the Ten Commandments, who could tell stories about Cecil B. DeMille, and I must say, she was a scrotum-tighteningly intimidating figure. "How are you, kid?" she said. Me? Dear. Her? Headlights. Before I could say anything, she walked toward me. "How did you find me, anyway?" An old issue of the Hollywood Reporter, I had no intention of saying. So I told her. "I heard about you when I worked on Patch Adams." She wasn't even listening. She turned to Chris and said, "He's beautiful. Miramax would love him." "Miramax?" I said. Her eyes were on me again now. "Are you meeting with anybody else?" "A couple people." She laughed. "Why? Why would you meet with anybody else? Who are you kidding? Come on, kid. Do you know who I am?" This was all playful, I think, except for the parts that weren't. Chris jumped in with waving, calming hands. "Okay, Iris, that's enough." I could tell that Chris was her assistant because he was the only person who could handle her. They had a routine, and moreover, they liked it. Iris walked back into the house without saying goodbye. Chris watched her go and turned to me and said, "We'd love to have you." A few minutes later, I signed a contract of representation. What had just happened was impossible. As I walked away from Iris's house, I kept wondering if I was going to wake up in the Saharan Motel. Chris and Iris got me my first audition a little over a week later. The part was Max Evans, the lead role in the Warner Brothers show Roswell. Tommy, who was almost as excited as I to hear that I got such a big audition, asked if he could help me with my lines. I said I'd let him know when they came in. Finally, they did, and I left him a message to ring me back. I missed Tommy's return call. When I played his message, I heard this. "Why do you have so many rings on the phone? It should only ring 3 times before a message. Change this shit, damn it. I hate this stupid beeping. No one likes the Mickey Mouse stuff. When I got Tommy on the line, he lectured me some more about my six rings. I tried to explain that three rings, in a lot of cases, didn't let you get to the phone in time. And then you had to stand and apologize to someone while your stupid message played. Tommy was adamant that three rings were more professional. Why the hell do you even care? I asked him. Let's run the lines, Tommy said. Come on, fax me the script. We do it together. I'd always gotten a kick out of running lines with Tommy. Tommy's approach to acting helped soothe my nerves and took my mind off the possibility of failure. Above all, he reminded me how important it was to have fun while performing. The only problem was that Tommy wanted to run my lines as his own. Tommy, I said, it's my audition. I like this Max character, he said, and started reading Max's lines in such a horrendously unconvincing way that all I could do was laugh. Max Evans is an alien. In this scene, he was talking to a girl he was falling in love with about being an alien. Maybe Tommy should have been auditioning for Roswell. The part had practically been written for him. I didn't get Max Evans, but ended up getting a callback for the other lead role, and the casting director said some nice things, including this. You're still a baby, remember? We'll be seeing you again. Tommy, his acting coach, was one for one. Iris and Chris wanted a few different selections of headshots to send out, so I headed for the nearest Kinko's. I got my hands on an Iris Burden Agency logo and made sure that it was featured prominently on all my headshot prints. She was, of course, my big and only selling point. The guy behind the desk at Kinko's, Seth, his name tag read, noticed this and said, "How long have you been with Iris Burden?" I told him only a week or two. Seth, an aspiring actor himself, promptly gave me some advice. I'd always heard actors normally maintain a solid distance between one another, but Seth was apparently uninterested in that little dance. He said, "What you should do is send out your headshots to all the casting directors. With that logo, you're going to get attention." Seth went in back and returned with all the relevant casting directors' addresses in handy label form. He called these the casting director label edition thing, Los Angeles. "So," he said, "send your headshot to everybody. Just send it out. In this town, you've got to rely on yourself. You've got to be your own agent. You've got a good agent, yeah, but you want to be doing a lot of the busy work." "Thank you," I said, a little overwhelmed and taken aback by his kindness. Seth shrugged. "That's what I would do if I had Iris Burden behind me." I bought the Kinko's casting director label edition thing. It came with 400 labels. And got to work. By the end of the weekend, I'd sent out around 300 envelopes with Iris Burden's name on them. What I didn't know was that Chris was out of town for the week, which meant that Iris would be answering her own phone if any of these casting directors reacted to the self-promotional carpet bombing I'd just given Hollywood. Of course, these casting directors would think that Iris had sent my headshots out, that she had some hot young heartthrob hunk of talent on her hands who was going to be the next River Phoenix. And right away, Iris's phone started ringing. They'd taken the bait. Before too long, she called me. "Honey, it's Iris," she said. "You really need to tell me what's going on. We've been getting calls about you every fucking minute. It's Greg Sestero, Greg Sestero, Greg Sestero. Did you send your picture out to everyone? Including the people that scrub the toilets? You're getting calls from everyone in town." "Oh, fuck. Oh, fuck. Listen to me, honey. Don't be so ambitious. It's unseemly." "I'm sorry, Iris." "Well, the VP of casting at Disney, Warner Brothers, and ABC all want a meeting. I'm telling the others he's adorable, but you can't meet him unless you have work for him. So go on and meet these ones, honey, but that's it. You've got to stop these mailings. They're driving me fucking nuts." In spite of this fiasco, Iris started getting me one audition after another, which is much more to her credit than mine. For my first few auditions, I superstitiously wore my Iris Burton meeting outfit, which is to say shorts and a short-sleeve shirt. This included an audition for a submarine flick with Matthew McConaughey. The casting director took one look at me and said, "Oh, how cute, he wore his shorts." I took this in stride, having decided to live or die by the shorts. One day I picked up a message from Chris. "You need to call me ASAP, buddy. We need to talk. I have an audition for something called Retro Puppet Master, which didn't come from us. There's also something else. Call me Greg, please. Bye."
All of it sounded weirdly ominous, especially that buddy.
Retro Puppet Master, though, sounded exceptionally strange. Actually, it sounded like something I was capable of getting. When I came in to see Chris, the first thing he said was, "So I got an irate phone call from the casting director of Patch Adams." At this, I may have gulped. I instantly knew what had happened. I was in Patch Adams, but not in a role the LA casting director had filled. My role was that of a featured extra, and that didn't belong on any resume. That casting director had seen Patch Adams on my resume and probably thought, "I cast all the primary parts in that film, who the hell is Greg Sestero?" I was absolutely in the wrong. "And what," I asked Chris, "did the casting director of Patch Adams say?" "She said she cast the movie and you weren't in it. So, word to the wise, you might want to leave that one off your resume from now on." Oh God, I thought. Iris and Chris are dumping me. This is a dumpable offense. Chris must have noticed my disintegrating spirits. "Look, Greg, forget her. Just don't, if you ever go in for her, just don't put that on your resume." "Okay," I said, exhaling. "Whatever you're doing, it's working. We're getting calls. And it's a good thing I'm back this week, believe me." Iris's hair was about to catch fire. "These Puppet Master people are going to be in touch with sides. I'll let you know." The way Chris said Puppet Master people made it perfectly clear what he thought about their particular production's value. I didn't care. When I got home, there were 6 messages on my answering machine, all from Tommy. The first, "Hey, yo, how's audition? Big encounter? Know what I mean? Ha, ha, ha." The second included Tommy's lilting rendition of "Hold on to the night." The third was him saying, "Don't be scared. Enjoy yourself. Life is beautiful. La, la, la. By the way, this girl Jennifer called me. You don't know her. She wants something." His messages kept getting weirder and weirder, but I couldn't really complain. So many actors who've just arrived in L.A. wind up doing all sorts of unpleasant jobs to stay afloat. Brad Pitt dressed up as a chicken for El Pollo Loco. Johnny Depp worked as an over-the-phone pen salesman. Surviving Tommy's message-a-thons was obviously the price I had to pay to live in his apartment. Finally, I returned Tommy's calls. He answered, as always, "I'm listening." "Tommy, what's up?" "So," he said, "I'm watching your show, The Bridges." I quickly realized he meant Nash Bridges, and the episode he was watching was the one in which I'd appeared. "It's just okay, you know. They do arresting with these guys, sissy guy with a handcuff. Know what I mean?" "Not really." "Sexuality, you don't know this stuff? Maybe you learn in 5 years from today. You put on the handcuffs and crazy stuff happened. I rest my case." I wanted and needed to steer the conversation in another direction pronto. "So, yeah, what's up?" Tommy was still absorbed in the show. "Oh," he said, "this guy has some issues, my God." "Tommy," I said. "Okay, I get the picture. So what was the name of school you auditioned before the Gene Shelton's class?"
"ACT.
"You know what I'm thinking? Maybe I take some classes there. Maybe I go to this ACT. Why not?
I tried Shakespeare in the voice class. I need to lose this stupid accent.
I knew suddenly that Tommy was somehow feeling challenged by me. All this time, he'd been living in San Francisco, doing his business, believing that taking acting classes was the best way to keep his dream alive. But now that I was in LA and auditioning for real projects, he realized that his dream was on the most pitiful form of life support. "Sure, Tommy," I said. "You should do that." But I was thinking that Tommy and ACT would be the worst possible match. ACT's instructors were top-notch and brutally honest. "By the way," Tommy said, "I get fat a little bit. What should I do?"
"Don't worry, I'm not your competition."
I wanted to laugh, but he sounded serious, almost dejected. "Get a stair stepper. Do it for 45 minutes a day."
"Where do you get stair stepper?"
"You can get one at Big Five or something." He started talking about something else, and I knew this little chat could go on for hours if I let it. "Hey, Tommy," I said. "I think I'm going to go grab a bite and learn my lines. I'll talk to you later, okay?"
Wait.
He never wanted to let me get off the phone, not even now, when nothing was being said.
"5 more minutes, okay?"
I could always sense Tommy's loneliness, and he was so lonely now, he was practically radioactive. "Okay," I said.
"I found a new restaurant in the Mission Street. Such good crepes, my God."
"Yeah, I'll try it next time I'm there. But I have to go."
"Wait, just a minute. Have you tried that Mama Papa deal down the Crescent Heights? Such good potato."
"Tommy, I've got to learn my lines."
"You get all these auditions. Wow, I'm so proud of you. Somebody have good luck, huh? Somebody has nice apartment."
"Yeah, we'll talk later." I hung up, went down the street, grabbed a bite, and returned home. I was gone a little over an hour, yet I had a message from Tommy waiting for me when I got back. All I heard at first was something rhythmic and repetitive happening in the background, beneath Tommy's huffing and puffing.
"I'm sweating like hell," he said.
In the time it took me to eat, he'd gone out and bought himself a stair stepper. I'd never seen any of the Puppet Master films, but I felt instantly attracted to André Toulon, their titular character. For one thing, Toulon was European, and I'd always felt as European as I did American. For another thing, Retro Puppet Master was a prequel that showed Toulon as a young Parisian puppeteer before he went mad with power and became the Puppet Master. Like any good Star Wars nerd, I thought, do it like you're doing Anakin Skywalker. An Anakin Skywalker who talks to puppets. Less heartening was the audition script, which was 4 pages of me speaking to newly arisen puppets whom Toulon has brought to life with a secret potion. In this audition, I was also expected to theatrically bestow upon Toulon's puppets their names as living beings. Dr. Death, Six Shooter, Cyclops, Blade, Tunneler. It was all monologue, basically, and easily the strangest thing I'd ever gone out for. Even less heartening, though, was that the audition called for a British accent, which I couldn't do. But I could do a French accent. The character actually was French, and I assumed they'd ask for a British accent because it was usually easier to find a young actor able to do one. A good French accent, I felt confident, would be my ace in the hole. The audition was at 1645 Vine Street, where Ed Wood made a few of his movies. I stood across from the casting people in the building's penthouse, a view of Capitol Records and the Hollywood sign visible behind them. I could tell they'd already seen a lot of people that day. I've since learned that James Franco was one of them. They looked bored, disheartened, and as drained as the empty Diet Coke bottle spread before them. The head casting guy decided to jab me right away. I'd sent in 4 separate headshots, all stapled together, all showing different looks, which I've since learned is a no-no. One is always enough. I'm surprised, he said, lifting up my staple headshots, that you didn't send us your baby photos. I said nothing. I had nothing. I smiled.